Okay, well, morning everyone. So Nick Coyle is my name. I probably have met a lot of you. I'm the CEO at OxCham. Thank you very much for joining. We've got about 190 people on the call at the moment. We'll have some more coming in, I'm sure, over the next few minutes. Can I say a big thank you to Ambassador, to the Ambassador for making time this morning, and also to Heather in Sydney, and to Dan, and also Deanna. Thank you to all the team at the Embassy. We hugely support the, we hugely appreciate your support. Now, people aren't here to hear from me, so I'm going to hand over very, very quickly to Ambassador Graham Fletcher to kick us off. Ambassador, thank you. Now, just a quick reminder to people, before I begin, this is Chatham House Rules, everyone, so please, no quoting anyone, make that crystal clear. If you've got any questions, email them through, and I'll just a final reminder before we get going to please mute your end, and also if you are using video, then to please turn your video off so we don't stress the internet infrastructure any more than we absolutely have to. So without further ado, over to Ambassador Fletcher. And yes, we are.
Yeah, we are recording, and it's going to be available.
Yes.
On your website.
Yep. Well, we'll have a look. So we are recording, and we'll endeavour afterwards. We'll have a look through, we'll endeavour to get this up on our website afterwards. But we'll see how we go. So if you do lose connection, don't stress too much. Okay, Ambassador.
Okay, well, thanks, Nick, and good morning or good afternoon, everyone, depending where you are. Thanks for taking the time to dial into this, and a slight apology that it's already 3 weeks since it really hit before we're doing this, but it's been a little busy, I think, for a lot of people. This is really an unprecedented challenge, mainly or for China in the first instance, but for all of us. Potentially as well. In terms of case numbers, we're now about 15 times what the peak was with SARS back in 2003. Now, of course, it's a different infection, but just as a way of comparison, SARS was quite significant at the time, and this one is potentially more so. Where are we? Well, we're through the initial phase, that's for sure, but I'd hesitate to say whether we're yet at the middle or at the peak. The infection rates in China continue, are slowing, but they continue to grow day by day. Clearly, Hubei province is the epicenter and greatly under stress with the number of infections there. But everyone knows this could get out of hand somewhere else, either within the mainland or offshore. And so authorities have got to be really careful. Comparisons with SARS, it seems to be a lot more infectious, even though it's less virulent or dangerous in terms of the number of fatalities. You'll have seen all the reporting about that cruise ship in Japan. Around 3,700 people on board, passengers and crew, ended up with over 620 positive cases there. 48 Australians are remaining in Japan under treatment, and we've evacuated a number back to Darwin. Two of those have now been tested positive. So it's a disease or it's an infection that you've got to be really careful about, and we certainly don't want it getting out of hand within Australia. Just another comparison with SARS, it's not actually useful, but I'll just say it anyway. The cases with SARS stabilised at about 60 days after the WHO issued their travel advice about SARS back in 2003. The comparison with this infection, we're at about day 40. So, you know, whether that's useful or not, I'll just mention that. And, of course, the people who are dealing with this, they're grappling with trying to treat the patients that they've got, fight the spread of infection, and also understand the disease. And trying to do those three things together, is pretty challenging. The data is as good as we can get it, but the authorities in each province are just, doing their best to get on top of that. The fact that there's an incubation period which is estimated at roughly, normally several days, but on the safe side up to 14, but in some rare cases can be longer, just it introduces another level of complexity. You can't be confident that you've actually got on top of it until you've waited a certain period. Of course, it's not just mainland China, it's spreading in certain other countries within this region. The potential, if it got out of hand in a country without the resources that China has to deal with, are quite scary. So all governments around the world, and particularly in this part of the world, this is one of their top priorities. Now, in China, what we've seen, severe disruptions to normal activity, all gatherings, meetings, schools, universities, transport is essentially paused. Many cities have a regulation that if you arrive from elsewhere in China, you need to stay home for 14 days, and that's being enforced quite rigorously. There are some apartment buildings even that access in and out is strictly controlled. Some areas of some cities have more stringent arrangements. In terms of what people do, nothing that was scheduled in February went ahead. Most things that are scheduled in March are being postponed, and we just are taking things step by step. The Australian government on the 1st of February increased the travel advice to the top level, which is do not travel to China. And if you're in China, seek a way to leave if you can. By commercial means. Now, normally there'd be about 170 flights every week between Australia and China. We're down to now less than 20. China Eastern and China Southern, if someone said to me, how can I get to Australia? I'd say, look on their websites. They're probably the ones operating regular services at a reduced level. China, Air China also possibly, but we're not sure that they're actually flying, even though they haven't suspended their services formally. Qantas, of course, has suspended their services to Shanghai and ended them to Beijing. Within China, of course, the big priority is to try and get things back to normal, but only 30% of migrant workers, as far as we understand, are back at their location of work, and whether they're able to work or not is TBC, because a lot of places are relying on inputs, transport, truck drivers, etc., and these things are still very much hit and miss. When you're dealing with a number of priorities, of course the economy is a priority, but health is a greater priority. And so most authorities, I think, are betting on the safe side when it comes to dealing with risk. Now, basis, and I'm not a medical expert, and so we're relying on advice that we get out of the Commonwealth Medical Officer, and there's a committee that meets, I think, on a daily basis between the states as well. Now, they're in direct touch with WHO. They've got access to all the information, and they monitor the levels of risk. They're looking at the number of new infections, the rate of infections, and the locations of them. The epidemiology of the disease is still being better understood, frankly. It is possible that there are many cases that are yet to be diagnosed simply because the individuals are not displaying symptoms. And that's good in a way, because that would mean that the fatality rate is actually lower than what we're seeing. But still, the potential for the infection to be spread by people who have absolutely no idea that they may have contracted it is something that people, the medical folk, are paying attention to. And as I said before, the fact of the incubation period means that there will need to be a period of time, once they're confident that the disease has stopped spreading, before they can actually say everything's fine again. And so people in Canberra are needing to weigh the costs of continued restrictions, which clearly has an economic cost for our country and a personal cost to individuals, versus the cost of a premature relaxation, which might lead to things getting out of hand. And I think if you see what's happened in South Korea just in the last couple of days, one individual turns up and within a matter of days you have 22 people affected. The effort required in contact tracing, quarantine, treatment of it getting out of hand is something that needs to be borne in mind. So with although our travel advice remains at level four, we are looking actively to at situation on the ground, and as soon as we feel that it can be credibly adjusted, we will feed that advice back into Canberra, which of course holds the pen on that. Now, that's going to be mainly a medical decision based on expert advice, but there are other considerations that we would look at in the mainland here, and several of those would be other schools operating again. Can you attend class if you're a university student? Can you travel between major cities in China? Can you have meetings with anybody? Can you visit the Great Wall, or you know, or can you, if you're a tourist, can you do what you'd want to do? Can you live a normal life? And at the moment, that is definitely no, you can't. And that's part of the reason why we say do not travel to China. There's no point. You get here, you're stuck in a hotel room for 14 days or whatever. Really, there's, for most people visiting China, it's not a good idea. And that's quite apart from the medical risk, which is real. And so those two factors need to be addressed. I would hesitate to put any time frame on when our travel advice will be adjusted. Now, we don't have to go back to level one. I mean, we can step it down. There are four levels. Level four is do not travel. Level three is reconsider your need to travel. Level two is exercise a high degree of caution. And then level one is just exercise normal degree of caution. And as soon as we can recommend an adjustment, we will do so. There were some questions about, so what's this? What's the impact of this on Australia's bilateral relationship with China? Well, on the one hand, it's actually a reminder that the things we've got a lot in common, and our extensive links with China are all affected by a disaster of this nature. This virus has no borders, and China deserves our support and sympathy as it is at the front line of dealing with this, and China's efforts and its success in managing this challenge is something that we all benefit from. If they can deal with it effectively within China and it does not become a worldwide pandemic, then of course we will all be very grateful. So we've expressed our support to China. There's been assistance provided by the Australian community and the government. We had a couple of aircraft evacuate some of our citizens who are vulnerable from Hubei province, and those aircraft brought in the material that we could spare in terms of protective gear and so forth. And the business community and the community more generally have also been responding, and there's one cargo flight that I'm aware of early next week which is bringing up tons and tons of material that's been donated from businesses and people in Australia. So that's a good thing. That shows, you know, our solidarity with our friends in China and the Chinese community at this difficult time. We have capabilities in terms of medical research, and there are, I think, three of our state's institutions have already made some progress with isolating the virus and doing what they do in terms of research into how can we understand it as a virus and deal with it. And we've been in touch with the Chinese embassy in Canberra to offer our willingness to collaborate with them. Of course, they've got a lot of on their plate at the moment, but if it's possible for Australia to assist China in terms of medical research, we certainly are willing to do so. So that's on the positive side. Now, on the negative, China's not particularly pleased with some of the measures we've taken, largely because it's affected their own community wanting to visit Australia and engage in normal activities. Now, we understand that, the measures that we've taken aren't unique to Australia. I mean, there are quite a number of countries around the world adopted measures of that nature. And we feel that our measures are not disproportionate to what's necessary. And in fact, if you look at some of the measures adopted within China itself, China is quite prepared to adopt, you know, quite strict measures in order to deal with the risk of infection. So we assure them that our measures are being reviewed constantly, and as soon as we feel that we can responsibly adjust them, we will do so. Another question about, so what can we do together in the region more broadly? Well, clearly China's a major player in Asia, and Australia is as well, and we would, if there are lessons learned from China's experience in dealing with the infection here, that can be applied. If there is a breakout in countries that are closer to us, we'd certainly be wanting to work with them. You know, we clearly have a very strong interest in the conditions in our immediate neighbourhood, South Pacific, East Timor, Indonesia, etc. And so we'd be that if the need arose, we'd certainly be talking to them about that. In terms of the Australian government presence in China, all of our offices remain open, but we have reduced our personnel here. All the family members and dependents have gone back home and done their 14 days. We've also trimmed back the staff, government staff that are here, mainly to just reduce our risk profile. If in fact, because when those decisions were made in late January, early February, we really didn't know, and we're still not absolutely confident of, you know, which cities are going to be most at risk, and we wouldn't want to have too many personnel here in the event that infection spiked in somewhere other than Hubei province. But we've got, you know, our main functions are communication with the Chinese government, communication with our citizens that are here, consular responsibilities, and of course looking after the operational needs to make sure that the lights stay on and we're all healthy and able to do the sort of critical work that our government still requires. So we've pulled back about 60% of our operational staff, and even our local staff are not fully back on deck yet, sometimes because of their own travel within China during the break. They're required to stay at home by the local authorities, and partly because we don't want to expose them to unnecessary risk. If there isn't sufficient work that needs them to come into the office, then they work from home. And different agencies are applying their own sort of requirements in that regard. So that's all I had to say by way of an opening spiel. That's probably long enough. Nick, over to you.
Terrific. Thank you, Ambassador. Look, what we might do next is I'm going to throw to Heather Cochin, who's the Chief Economist at Austrade, to give us a bit of a briefing, and then I'll hand over to Dan. And then what we'll do is take some questions. So we'll hopefully have a good sort of 20 to 30 minutes for Q&A, but I'll hand over to Heather now, and then be back with you shortly. And anybody, if you've got any questions, please send them through and I'll get to as many as we can. Over to you, Heather.
All right. Can everyone hear me? I'll at least look to Beijing to see if you're nodding.
Got it.
Yep. Good. All right. Okay. So hi all. I'm the Chief Economist at Austrade. So first of all, I understand the kind of first question is, how is this affecting Australia's trade and Australia's exports in particular? So most obviously and immediately, because of the travel ban and the travel restrictions, it's affecting our services exports, the biggest one of which is tourism. So we have about 1.4 million Chinese tourists that come to Australia every year. That's on average about 120,000 a month, but it turns out that February is the peak month for Chinese travellers to Australia. As a result of Chinese New Year, the new uni semester starting, new schooling, all of those sorts of things. So it does mean not only would have this been convenient at any point in time, but for tourism, it is in fact the most inconvenient month to have an epidemic of this type. And so we are seeing, of course, just an enormous slump in Chinese tourists. And we're still seeing people, of course, able to come here through different channels if they come via a third country and they've been outside of China for more than 2 weeks. But China also happens to be our highest yielding tourism market in terms of the length of time that Chinese tourists come for and the amount of money that they spend while they're here. It's a really valuable tourism industry for us. So we know that that's really having an impact on tourism in Australia. Most immediately, Chinese tourists come to our capital cities. So in a way, that means that the impact has been softened somewhat because we also get a lot of other visitors to those cities. So primarily, I mean Sydney, number one, Melbourne, number two, Brisbane, number three, and then far north Queensland. So that's really where Chinese visitors come. We, of course, are suffering a weakened impact on the tourism industry after Australia's recent bushfires as well. So by and large, the bushfires immediately affected regional areas in mostly New South Wales and Victoria. But on top of the kind of negative sentiment from the bushfires, this as well means that our tourism sector is really struggling at the moment, which is part of the reason why the Australian government announced a very big response package for the tourism sector. Number two affected industry is international education. So again, this really couldn't have been a worse month because it is the month where Chinese visitors and students studying were planning to return to Australia, but the vast majority had not. So we have about 250,000 international students from China across all of our education cohorts, and around 150 of those are in higher education, which is our most kind of prominent education sector. And as of 1 Feb, which is the latest figures I've seen, about 100,000 students remained offshore. So we know, and we've certainly seen media coverage, that students are attempting to get around this by kind of travelling via Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia to make sure that they can be outside the exclusion period. But there still is a dramatically high number of students that are not able to make it to start school on time. And we are seeing a kind of very sympathetic response from the international education sector to think about what else they can do for those students. So delaying semester, offering courses online, things like that. But it clearly is having a big impact. That is more than sort of more evenly distributed towards our G8 universities and in our capital cities again. So Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra in particular is heavily affected as well. It's kind of at a critical point too for higher education in that this week and next week are kind of the last couple of weeks where semester could have commenced as normal. And I know that unis are really trying to think actively about what will happen if the ban goes on much longer. And the most obvious response we think is that students will defer, particularly where they are partway through a qualification. The bigger challenge will be for new students who might find this really challenging and in fact look to go elsewhere, which is not something we would hope to see, but remains a possibility. Very hard to predict at this stage because we haven't seen an event like this before, but is something that I've certainly started thinking about. The third affected sector in the short term is the agricultural sector in terms of fresh produce exported to China. And number one, Chinese New Year events have been, of course, dramatically downscaled so that people aren't kind of consuming the things they would have otherwise consumed. Number one, in terms of the media coverage, is lobsters and seafood, which we are seeing a lot of media coverage on, and which is particularly challenging because that, again, was kind of a peak month for that commodity, and more around kind of table grapes, fresh produce, things like that as well. By and large, Austrade has been available to help supporters, and we understand those commodities have been able to find another market, but of course, perhaps not at the price premium they might have otherwise been able to. I think as well, the challenge will be that for a few weeks, we sent a lot of that produce by air freight, but we'll have to start seeing our exporters think about shipping that by air freight if we can't actually get it there because the number of flights is dramatically reduced. Now, beyond the immediately affected sectors, the other thing that I'm increasingly interested in is consumer confidence and sentiment and the bigger kind of impacts that will come from having not just a kind of short-term production hit in China, but a real slowdown in manufacturing and all of these kind of different sectors which rely on Australian commodities and exports to actually feed into their production. And there's many commentators speculating about what Chinese growth might be in the next quarter, but from 6% down to 4% is for this quarter is some of the estimates I've seen. And of course, China is Australia's last year's trading partner. So anything that happens in China, including, you know, literally if China were to catch a cold, that would have an impact on the Australian economy as well. Going into 2020, we saw in the last couple of days, the Australian economy has been holding up pretty well, but after a really pleasing unemployment figure of 5.1% in December, we saw it rise to 5.3%. And we are, of course, watching the impact this has on Australian business and Australian confidence as well. And both of these things, are, in terms of the bushfires and coronavirus, are having a compounding effect. If we had one of these events isolated by itself, we'd be in a stronger position, but the two really close together means that for most of our kind of international markets there, where we might think, well, if we've had just one market take a hit, we can look to other markets. We know that the media coverage and the kind of conservatism in travel generally towards Australia has meant in a lot of domains we're actually seeing people being less cautious and people not wanting to travel here. And so we are seeing a lot of bookings in travel down as well. The challenge will be once the ban comes off to actually look at what that would mean in terms of an influx as well. So how do we actually ramp back up once we get to the adjustment phase, which Daniel certainly mentions a lot, is it's not as easy just to restart everything up as well if you put it on hold. And how do we actually reallocate our resources to make sure we're positioned for when that happens? So I think the challenge will be just to look at once we return to normal what that looks like and how quickly we can adjust to kind of scaling back up, because that's normally harder than people think as well. And I'm happy to take questions once we get into the discussion.
Okay, great. Look, just before I hand over to Dan, I thought what I'd do is we've had a survey out for the past week and a half or so, and we are in the process of compiling that, and we'll release it early next week. But I thought I'd give you a quick bit of insight as to what our members are saying. 88% are reporting either a significant 52% or slight 36% negative impact, not wholly surprising, with 36% expecting a greater than 20% decrease in 2020 revenue. Now, this figure seems to be much higher for smaller companies with less than 50 employees than for larger ones. 18% have already said that they're entering new markets, with Vietnam and other Southeast Asian nations, as well as the Middle East, the most popular. 29% have not closed their office, so 71% have. 36% don't know when their offices will reopen. And this return to normalcy is probably the biggest factor that's coming through in our survey data. And we've got about 80% of companies that are implementing work from home practices, which seems to be the most common way to handle things at the moment. So that's what our members are saying. Dan, I'll hand over to you.
Thanks, Nick. For those that don't know me, my name is Daniel Boyer. I'm the general manager for Austrade in China, based out of Beijing. I was just going to, I'll be quicker, I hope, than our previous two speakers. I do really want to leave time for Nick to funnel some questions through. I did want to quickly talk about our current staffing arrangements in across Greater China, our priorities in the coming weeks and months, and just a little bit of on-the-ground feedback to help add some colour and movement to Heather's report on a couple of sectors in particular. In terms of our staffing arrangements, as the Ambassador mentioned, we were directed by the Foreign Minister for non-essential staff and dependents to leave. What that's meant for Austrade is that there are now only four Australian-based staff left in China. That is me in Beijing, Liu Bing in Shanghai, Dane Richmond in Guangzhou, and Tim White in Chengdu. All our other A-based officers have returned to Australia as directed, but they are currently still managing their teams remotely, and we are quite lucky in Austrade to be able to do a lot of remote work, which means that pretty much as soon as they got off the plane and got into their hotel for 14 days, I told them that they were back to work. So in a nutshell, we're still here, we're still contactable, and we're happy to hear from you and help if we can. Probably best to reach out to us by email at this stage, given that most of us aren't in the office, particularly our local staff. They are still working from home, but they are not in the office at this stage, and we're looking over the next couple of weeks to how and when we bring some of them back into the posts. In terms of our work priorities, our immediate priority is always going to be the safety and the health and well-being of our staff. After managing the departure of our families and some of our A-based staff, our attention has turned to normalising our unusual working arrangements as much as we can. Most pressing need that we have is to provide people with information, people in government, people in the Australian business community, our Chinese commercial colleagues, But we're now turning our minds to the recovery phase, as Heather mentioned, what we're calling the bounce back. My motto at the moment is, and this too shall pass, because it will, and when it does, all of us will need to be ready to do whatever we can to reinvigorate the deep and vital commercial relationship that exists between Australia and China. For Austrade, this will mean providing up-to-date information for business, bringing clients to market, supporting our clients to find partners, importers, distributors and customers, helping investors find high-quality projects in Australia and driving social media engagement with Australia, with our capability and our produce across key sectors like energy, health, food and beverage, agribusiness, education, and with Tourism Australia around tourism too. That's all the stuff we normally do, but the pace and the importance of the work will be more pronounced than ever before. And we hope that the resumption of business as usual here kind of coincides with some planned activities we have in market, like our Festival of Australia program, which is a trance of activities and coordinated social media engagement that last year included about 40-odd events with partners across 11 cities and culminated in the AFL game in Shanghai. At the moment, festival is still planned for May-June. Our drop-dead date for shifting is the end of March, when many of the airlines have said that they'll restart flights into China, subject to the coronavirus situation. Watch this space. We will, of course, engage widely with our partners and our colleagues in making a final decision. In terms of business impacts, as Heather said, it's the people industries that have been most challenged over the last little while, students and international education and tourism. But obviously, it's also having an impact across a number of other sectors too. For example, all the flight cancellations are causing a significant decline in fresh and perishable food exports, seafood in particular. This is compounded by port capacity here. All ports, with the exception of Wuhan River Port, are still open, but some are operating at a reduced capacity because many of their workers haven't been able to return to work. There's also the restrictions on interprovincial, intercity and sometimes even intra-city travel, which have made it difficult to move product within China even when it gets through the port. We're also hearing anecdotally about an impact on supply chains for a whole raft of different products like food packaging. Not the biggest impact on Australia in terms of supply chains. Obviously, the Japanese, Korean and to a lesser extent US and Europe have significant supply chains out of China, particularly in things like the auto industry. And some of them are actually based in Hubei province, which has made it almost impossible for them to keep going. However, there's still impacts here through extended holidays in China, reduced operating capacity of factories, and the travel restrictions for goods and people. While factories are slowly returning to work across China now, it will take some time for them to get back to full operations. There are suggestions that somewhere more than half of the 300 million migrant workers who travelled for Chinese New Year are still yet to return to work, and provincial governments are requiring a range of assurances from some companies before they're allowed to reopen. One importer up in Dongbei, for example, complained that they needed the approval of 8 different government agencies before they restarted their business. So that gives you an idea about the bureaucratic challenges as well as the more broader challenges. There's no doubt that China will bounce back and with it the demand for Australian capability and product, but the speed of that bounce from my perspective will be determined more by a return of consumer confidence than by the end of the virus. Anyone who's taken a walk through Beijing, Shanghai or any of the major cities recently will tell you that there are very few people on the streets, in the restaurants or in the shops. Granted, that's seen a surge in online purchases in some sectors, but we know it's affecting the hospitality, retail, real estate and broader service sectors because local governments are announcing stimulus measures like for SMEs like loan extensions and rental subsidies. That drain in consumer confidence will potentially last longer than the virus, and the knock-on effect of a decline in the service industry to other sectors, like energy, for example, is quite real. How pronounced that decline is will determine, as I say, how quickly China bounces back and with it the speed of the recovery of our own commercial engagement with China. On the positive side, we have a good reputation across a number of sectors, and this will last through the virus and help us in the recovery. Our food and bev, dairy, meat, seafood, etc., is very highly regarded, marketed very well in market, with high name recognition and inbuilt demand. Our health sectors are complementary, with activity across medical devices, treatment, clinical trials, aged care, health education and training, and a whole range of other subsectors within health. It's actually the fastest growing area of Chinese investment into Australia at the moment as well. And actually, potentially, will grow even more quickly after the virus departs the scene. Our education and tourism sectors will rebound. We offer desirable and high quality product in both at a competitive price point. Energy and resources, which for so long has been a linchpin of our relationship with China, they're long-term industries and long-term demand is unlikely to drop substantially. In short, China will still offer opportunities for Australian exporters across a range of sectors. And that's probably the messages I wanted to leave people with. One, that the opportunities that made China a great place to do business 2 months ago are still there and will still be there after COVID-19 has left us. And two, that Austrade's here to help. While we've got a pretty skinny Australian team on the ground at the moment, we are still here. Just get in touch with us. Nick.
Dan, thank you very much. Now, look, I'm going to kick off with Q&A. I've got quite a few questions rolling in, so what I might do is try and condense them into a few areas. Look, education has been really key. Ourselves at AusCham, we've put out a statement around this and had a bit to say. One of the things from an AusCham perspective that we've been seeing is that we've already had word from investment advisory firms, Chinese ones, that investment shifting away from Australia already into Canada and other markets as a result. We've also, as a result of the restrictions we've got in place. So one, I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Secondly, I've got a few questions here about, you know, some crystal balling, you know, in terms of, you know, when do we think some restrictions could be lifted? Also some questions around, is there anything else we could do to try and facilitate the flow of students back in? Are there other mechanisms we could look at in terms of quarantine measures and those sorts of things? So they're the sorts of questions I'm getting around education. Ambassador, I'll give you an easy one to start with.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, the decision point is at the end of this coming week, the next review of those restrictions. I mean, I think I'm sure all of our major institutions are in touch with the education department on ways which, you know, creative things that we can do if the restrictions remain, or they are remaining for the next 7 days at least. And that is, there's some enterprising people offering 2 weeks in Bali or somewhere else on your way to start your classes. Certainly things are being done with online delivery of classes and deferrals. Now that, you know, it's just, no one can say with confidence, is this a 1 week thing, a 2 week thing, a 1 month thing? They're all possible, and I'm not going to put a time frame on it. And it may be that, some universities in China are saying, let's forget about this semester, we'll see you back in September. Now, clearly that's not something that we're prepared to say at the moment. It's going to be based on the advice of those experts who are looking at infection rates and locations. And until they give a tick to the government, I don't see the government wanting to move to relax things. Now, in the meantime, if an institution can encourage its potential students to go somewhere else for 2 weeks, clearly that's an expense, but that may be a, you know, the least worst option, so to speak.
Okay. And I know that some universities have tried to look at offering courses online, but there's the associated problem sometimes with the firewall here, and I've read bits and pieces that Australia's working with China to try and address some of those. Have you got any knowledge about how that's going?
I've heard that there have been conversations with the Chinese authorities in Canberra about making it accessible for people, certain platforms, And I thought that those conversations were going well, but I've not heard the outcome of them.
Okay, great. Now, we've heard I'll shift off from education for the moment, but of course, guys, if you've got questions for me, just send them through. There's been a range of different sort of stimulus packages, you know, I mentioned before with some of the statistics from our members and, of course, from what Dan and Heather were saying. There's been some stimulus packages on the ground here in China, not hugely coordinated at this point in time, but it's certainly helping business, and we're seeing different areas roll out programs. So have you got any thoughts as to whether Australia might look to assist business as well? And have you got any ideas on how that might look?
Well, certainly there was a bushfire response package in relation to tourism, which is now being broadened, I think, to deal with this virus, because, you know, tourist operators in Australia who are suffering because of bushfires are also suffering similarly because of the virus. Sorry, I don't actually know what other measures may be being contemplated, but the government is certainly willing to think about a whole range of things that we can do. Now, you mentioned online education. There is actually a rule about online education which is designed to prevent a university offering a full degree to someone who lives in Iceland who never comes to Australia but just does it all online. You can't actually do that in Australia. There's a kind of a limit on how much of a course can be delivered through an online mechanism. You know, a student in Australia may want to avail themselves of online things because of, you know, what their working environment or whatever. Now we're prepared to, or people in Canberra who deal with that are quite happy to relax that at the moment because of the special situation. So if there are other things where government, normal government policy actually becomes a hindrance, then by all means say something. I should have said earlier, you know, we're offshore, we're not plugged in the way that people are in Canberra. Things that we say, certainly listen to what we say, but look at the websites. The Department of Education, the Department of Health has the up-to-the-minute advice as to what the procedures are. Similarly, DFAT with its travel advice. You know, you'll read stuff in the newspapers, but don't just take it from there. Go to the websites, because that's where the up-to-date, accurate information is.
Mm-hmm. And I've got another question. So, messaging so far from Australia about the travel ban has been quite perfunctory. Can we encourage a more sympathetic message from Australia with acknowledging the impacts on business and individuals, as this might go quite a long way towards mitigating some of the, you know, damage out there in the marketplace? What can government and people do to sort of soften that message? And I guess I'll put a second part to that. Do you think people back in Australia, and I know it's hard for you to comment too specifically, understand that that's a bit of a challenge at the moment?
Look, I think they do. I mean, it's a pretty tough measure to say if you've been in China, you can't cross the border into Australia unless you're an Australian citizen or a permanent resident or a family member of an Australian citizen. And there's not a lot you can do to... I mean, the Health Minister and the Prime Minister have said this is a dangerous situation and we have to put health first. And I think the Australian community supports that. And in fact, there's stories the other way where, you know, our staff who've gone home have had trouble booking themselves into a hotel because people in Australia are thinking, you've just come from China, it's not safe. Mm. And, you know, our advice is it is safe. Someone can check themselves in a hotel, stay there for 14 days, they're all clear. So there's a level of, I think the government has to deal with, you know, the sentiment in the community and respond to expert advice in a way that is sensible for our own community. Now, at the same time, we are, you know, we care a lot about the poor students who can't come, the tourists who've had their plans disrupted. And, you know, the Prime Minister, again, we've put up on the Weibo in Beijing some comments that he's made about, you know, concern for the Australian Chinese community in Australia who, you know, people aren't going to Chinese restaurants because, you know, they think they might get infected or something. I mean, that's a level of overreaction perhaps at sometimes in parts of our community which we're trying to downplay and send a very strong message of support to China itself, that we're with them in this and that we want to, you know, we'll do what we can to help them.
The only thing I'd add to that, Nick, is I know there's some exceptional efforts going on in the private sector to help drive some of that very positive messaging. Mm-hmm. The flight that the ambassador mentioned next week that's being run to directly to Wuhan is a great example of that. But there's also, a lot of really good opportunities for this group of people to help spread that message through social media engagement. China has several great advantages, but one of them is that we are, most of us, on a single platform in WeChat. And so the opportunity to actually get messages to, if you pardon the pun, to go viral is quite high. I think it's a good thing for us as a group of people, not just government, but for us as a group of people to take some ownership of that and really drive some of those positive messages.
Now, I've got one more toughie for you, and then we might move on to a couple of other areas. Ambassador, have you seen or what sort of blowback might you anticipate from China as a result of our policy that's probably been a bit harder than some other countries?
If you look at what the Chinese ambassador has said in Canberra, I mean, they're clearly unhappy that we've taken the action we have. They're similarly unhappy with quite a lot of other countries. I mean, Russia has stopped any Chinese citizen going to Russia, regardless of where you come from or how long you've been out of China. Now, we are not, this is not a thing about Chinese people. It's about the geographic place where people may have picked up an infection. We understand that they're unhappy about that. We feel, and they say, look, this is costly. And we say, you bet it's costly. We know it's costly, and we prefer not to have to do this. But frankly, we see no alternative at the moment. And as soon as we can adjust it, we will do so. Mm-hmm. We recognise that sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. As Dan said, things will resume business as usual at some point in the next couple of months.
Well, getting on to that, let's look at some other sort of issues. I've got a question here from Tom. There's been some discussion that Australian agriculture, with its reputation for being clean and green, may be one of the first sectors to bounce back, and I think Heather touched on that and Dan to a degree. Given the source of this virus is a Wuhan market, now, are there any signs of this as yet, and do you feel for which Australian agricultural goods might have a good opportunity going forward?
That's a good question. Only anecdotal at the moment. Yep. It's just too early, basically. But the gut feel from the discussions that we've had with some of our partners in the industry is that seafood and meat will bounce back at some stage. We're probably a little underdone on fresh fruit coming into fresh fruit and veg coming in, and that's a discussion we've been having with Horticulture Innovation in Australia a little while ago, and perhaps that's another opportunity for us. I think one of the other sectors outside of ag that will obviously benefit, and it sounds terribly cynical to say it, but will be the health sector. Mm-hmm. There's so much already happening in health, but you could just see this. The two breakthroughs in Australia got quite wide coverage here. For anyone who's been here for a while, would have seen that. That opened up the Chinese public's eyes to what we have known for a while, which is there are significant opportunities in the health sector. So they're probably the ones that I suspect will bounce quickly. And also, of course, things like infant formula, we've actually seen significant growth over the last little while in that too. So they're probably the areas that, off the top of my head, that I'd say bounce.
Nick, can I add to that one?
Please.
The interesting thing in talking to my colleagues in ABARES about the impact on agriculture has been that Australia's been in a pretty severe drought, and that has actually meant that export volumes to China have been lower than they otherwise would have been. So we were not at the kind of peak of exports that we might have expected. It's meant that prices have held up a bit more, but volumes have been reduced. We've seen a bit of rain in Australia the last couple of weeks, but not enough to think that we're out of the woods. The other thing that is interesting in terms of the longer term dynamics is we were certainly chatting within the economics team that African swine flu and its impact on the pork sector has meant that all else equal demand for other Australian proteins, particularly beef and sheep, we actually thought there were some prospects in those areas because there really was a switch in consumer behaviour that looked to be apparent as people were actually looking to, you know, eat more widely and do different things there. I guess the interesting thing will be the next few months in terms of Australia's ability to actually supply that. If we're still in a drought, both in grains and in, well, everything from kind of almonds and fresh fruit through to animal proteins, it has been a challenging time for the agricultural sector anyway.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're right, Heather. I think that we'll have as many issues on the supply side as we will on the demand side around some of our egg products.
Okay, great. Now, on touching on a similar theme, a question from Michelle. Outside of Festival Australia, are Austrade or the government planning any other business development or publicity events to sort of kickstart demand for Aussie products?
I wouldn't be in a position to announce them even if they were, because that will be something that the government makes decisions on, I'm sure. Look, as the Ambassador said, it's a reasonably substantial package put together for the tourism industry. There is talk all the time in Canberra in government circles about what can be done to help, but just, you know, keep an eye out on media announcements from various ministers would be what I'd say.
Okay, great. Now, I've got a question here from Jerome Gertz, talking a bit about supply chain and intermediate goods. So with Australia placing a ban on ships that have called into China after the 1st of Feb, what Gert is saying at the moment, we're seeing a lot of ships that are being sourced from elsewhere to export Australian cargo, but this will run out shortly. So due to a lot of freight being China-bound, have you got a take on when measures might be taken to ensure that ships who have called into China might be able to look at coming to Australia again, or is that all going to pretty much be tied together, do you think, with all the other measures?
Just Deanna, to clarify in response to that question, so there's no ban on ships entering Australia. There are quarantine measures at Australian ports in relation to ships that have been to China, but there's no ban in place. We do expect that there are some delays in shipping logistics, particularly at the China end, in relation to congestion at ports, which is having a significant impact, we understand, on freight, as well as on the production side here, as Daniel was saying earlier, with plants still sort of coming back to business. But we are looking to manage that as much as we can. And importantly, the measures in place in Australia are only in relation to timing and quarantine, but ships are still getting through and all the information is on the Department of Home Affairs website.
There was a big update on that earlier this week or late last week, I can't recall. But yeah, there's a good fact sheet now for on Home Affairs website, as Deanna says.
Okay, terrific. So Jerome, now you know where to go looking for more information. I've got another question actually that's just come in from Susan. So for looking at migration and applications and students, apparently there's quite a few students that might have expiring visas and might have a problem meeting the Australian study requirement given the current restrictions. So is this going to be taken into account, do you think, by Home Affairs?
I'm happy to take that one on board as well. And so this is one of the areas where, as the Ambassador said, there's been a lot of creative thinking that is going on in Australia about how to make the situation as easy as possible for students that are returning. The students whose visas will expire, there are measures in place to review those so that those visas can be extended when those students are ready to return to Australia. So yes, this is something that Australia's been thinking about very carefully. There are special measures being implemented. And again, there's a lot of information on the Home Affairs website for students and for education providers in relation to how visa matters will be handled.
Okay, great. And Ambassador, I've got another question that's just come in. So have you got any thoughts or observations on the potential aftermath in the political fields in China? I know that'll be a fun one to answer. Any thoughts about how that might drive some reform here?
Well, It could be a significant thing for China as a country as it goes forward. I mean, I'm not going to talk out loud about what those impacts might be, but it's already had some implications. There's been a few personnel movements. A minor thing in a way, but the annual session of the National People's Congress, which would normally begin at the beginning of March, has now been, it will be delayed. They haven't actually said that, but it's not going to go ahead on schedule. So that's also going to have a bit of an impact. But yeah, nothing. This is a big thing for China to deal with, and you know they'll get on top of it. But it will have ripple effects, I think, throughout their system.
Interesting. Now, yesterday we were talking with Professor Lewin from the Doherty Institute, and she sort of talked a little bit about obviously what we're doing in Australia and some of the research and development that's happening over here. Just wondering, Dan or Heather, whether you see that Australia and China can do a lot more together going forward, working on these sorts of areas, not only with identifying and developing vaccines and the technical side of it, but also crisis management and working together.
Oh, definitely. I think that one of the most complex and interesting relationships we have at the moment is in the health sector. As I said, you know, it crosses everything from medical devices to health education and training to aged care facilities to human trials to significant research and development. And it's an interesting and complex relationship because you see Australian investment in China with firms like Cochlear firmly established here now and Chinese investment into Australia as well. And so the trade flow is both ways, the investment flow is both ways. It's very interesting. So I think if you were to look at any sort of a positive out of a terrible situation like this, it will almost certainly bring our health sectors closer together than they already are. And that will be good for, you know, for a whole range of human reasons, but it'll also be very good for commercial reasons as well. That would be my hopeful expectation.
Terrific. Well, thank you. Now, look, we're nudging up on 11 o'clock. What I thought I might do just to round off is I might do a quick round the table for some final thoughts. Heather, I'll throw to you first. Have you got any final thoughts that you want to communicate out to the community?
Perhaps on something that's especially helpful, but it's really interesting to see the impact that uncertainty has on decision making. And to the extent that anyone asks me, that's what I'm saying is really damaging for business. When you know what the risk is, you can quantify it and you can do something about it. And when we're in a holding pattern, I know just how difficult that is for people to make decisions. So I'm really hoping that we have another couple of weeks of uncertainty, but as the disease kind of continues to play out and we know what we're up against and that allows our government to make more certain decisions, the quicker that can happen, the quicker then I know businesses can actually respond and make the business decisions they need to make for the rest of this year.
Terrific. Thank you. Deanna, Dan?
Just that we're very happy to share all of the information and website links with Auschem that we've mentioned today so that they can be made available to members that will have all of the latest up-to-date information.
Terrific. Thank you. Ambassador?
Well, it's a bit of a sort of folk wisdom, but we hope for the best, but we need to plan for the worst. But what by that I mean we all want this to be cleared up in a week or two, but we need to be a little patient, and it could be a month or two, not just a couple of weeks.
Well, thank you so much. The only final thing I'll add to people in Australia who have tuned in, I can tell you Beijing this week is a lot busier than it was last week. So I'll echo the thoughts of the ambassador there that it might take a little bit of time for things to get back to normal. But as Dan said, it will, and China's a pretty resilient place. So look, we're now at 11 o'clock. Thank you so much to Ambassador Fletcher for being so generous with your time and answering some fun questions. Thank you to Heather, Deanna, Dan. Thanks to Austrade as in general for letting us use their terrific facilities. And, you know, it's really great that we're able to do this in the way that we are, because a lot of countries out there wouldn't allow us this sort of access. So we greatly appreciate it. We will, Chick, from an AusChem perspective, we do have yesterday's webinar up on our website that we did with Professor Lewin. We will be doing some industry-specific stuff over the coming weeks and touching base as regularly as we can with all the key decision makers, not only over here but in Australia as well. Thank you. Thanks everyone. Have a great day and have a great weekend.